So whose intro is it?
It's yours, it was me last time.
Oh, excellent. I shall put on my bestest voice and that.
Please do, and that.
And that. Well, hello and welcome to what is the 104th episode of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and him.
Scott Caffon-René.
Well, how are you on what is the eve of National Adoption Week? Tingling with anticipation, fizzing with excitement?
No.
All right, why not, you miserable toad?
What? We talked about this very briefly in the last time we spoke, I think. Did we? Or was that not recorded? That may have been just been a discussion that you and I had, actually.
The voices.
I've just realised. Damn. Shall I just put my...
Put it out there. Come on. Yeah. Before you do, can I just give a shout out to Ed Ross, Jane Bolan, got all the way through the last episode and emailed us. So shout out to you guys. Freaking rock stars.
Yeah, right. I know. National and Matt, there's a box of frogs that they actually listened right to the end.
Maybe they fell asleep and woke up at that
point.
Yeah,
maybe. Yeah, just
woke
up.
That's more likely, isn't it?
Yeah. Right, National Adoption Week. So, if you'd asked me about National Adoption Week 5 years ago, I'd have been, oh, it's amazing. It's this. It's a great recognition that there's lots of good work going on and there's, you know, all this stuff that goes on during the week and blah, 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 blah. And now maybe I think perhaps as well, it's kind of compounded this year with the hashtag You Can Adopt campaign, maybe.
A little bit more going on this year, isn't there, than last year? Last year was a dud.
Can
we call it a dud?
To be fair, I think there was quite a big lot of funding kind of pulled from. Yeah. Anyway, but that aside, and I just think it's always about recruitment. Always about recruitment. And
you had an idea, didn't you?
I had an idea, and I did actually. I did it because we both take part in some of this kind of recruitment stuff that's going on at the minute, but we're kind of late to the party. And when I say late to the party, we didn't get invited until the campaign went out. The meetings didn't start anyway. But essentially, my idea was that actually the 5 days Adoption Week is on should focus on something different each day. So, as an example, birth families. As an example, adopted people, adopted young people, adopted adults, you know, whatever, kind of the whole kind of range, hearing from them, getting their views, and adoptive parents, and maybe extended family from the birth family, that kind of thing. It should be more focused around that.
A spectrum across the week.
Exactly. Because there's more than just one kind of, you know, a National Adoption Week, I guess in my head, when I first kind of got involved in it all, it was very much focused on adopted parents. And whilst that was maybe lovely back then, I think, you know, we keep on talking about the Children Act generation. And I think because we're listening to what they've got to say, and also not just the Children Act generation, you know, there's a lot of kind of older adopted people who are kind of holding their hands up going, actually, I've got some issues
valid.
With this thing as well. Yeah, exactly.
Valid experience, so, valid opinions,
That's so, yeah, so that's my thing. And I did put it to them, and I'm sure I did it before I put it to them, but I don't think we've had that kind of audience before. And it was the lady who's been in charge of the kind of, what's it called, the campaign and the filming that went on and stuff. And she seemed quite keen to think about that for next year. Because this year's set, you know, in terms of what they're doing, all the kind of the funding has been used up to do what it's got to do stuff. So yes, it's a nice idea, but it's like
it feels tired, doesn't it, as a format?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And because of the You Can Adopt campaign, of course, again this year it's focused around recruitment. Now, you know, love or hate adoption, it's here, and we do need people who can be great parents. You know, so we have to try and find them, but at the same time, you know, there are other areas of adoption that we could celebrate or look into, or you know,
so we'll make that happen for next year. We'll make that happen, shall we? That'll be something to do. I do think that the word on the street is that they may announce the new chair of the Adoption Special Guardians Leadership Board. That should be interesting. I am intrigued to know who that's going to be, whether that
well I am as well
Partially because I can confess it's not me.
Yeah, I know.
I put you.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Are you going to tell the story or are you not?
Well, I kind of. I had a moment of madness and I decided I would apply. And
moment.
Well, yeah, probably a full-on, yeah, full-on
3 weeks
episode.
Of madness. Yeah, exactly.
And the reason I decided to apply was because I just thought, actually, we had Martin Neri, who was kind of, he inhabited a real space where he was, he raised the profile of adoption to 2011, and he massively introduced this idea that adoption is a thing still. He sort of totally refreshed the whole concept, not the law, but just the idea of this thing. There was, I think it was in conjunction with the Times. There was a whole raft of publicity that just created this juggernaut that then pushed through lots of, I think, lots of awareness, lots of resurgence that kind of, and that wave travelled all the way through right up until maybe 2015-16. But in the meantime, Andrew Christie then took it on board, and he was kind of tasked with changing the structures. So I guess his role was taking us from a position of RAA, of no RAAs, to RAAs. So we're effectively at the end of that process now, are we?
More or less, yeah, I think so.
But yeah, I guess.
With the exception of maybe one or two, but yeah.
But just about there. And I just thought that actually maybe they want a different sort of person, somebody who's going to maybe push through a different... something that is more about adopter representation or adoptee representation. It's about representation of people who are impacted. Just on a side note, if you've got this far and you're waiting for pause, pause are coming. We're going to speak to them in a little bit. And so I thought I'd apply, but obviously I didn't even get an interview because clearly they looked at me. And I think I'm going to run with this, the idea that they said, will you be happy for someone to go through your social media? And I think they looked at the task of that and just basically said, let's not even bother. There's bound to be something deeply, deeply concerning.
I don't think they would even have had to look through your social media. I think they know what your social media is about.
You flatter me. But so that's interesting. I think that I'm really intrigued to know who that'll be.
I think it'll be interesting to see where they come from as well. So what their background is and what their experience is, because there would be nothing better than it being, you know, someone who, yes, we're all affected by adoption, whether you're, you know, in all different levels. But actually, it would be really, really nice to see if it was somebody from a kind of different aspect. So, you know, maybe an adopted person or, something along those lines, because it... Yeah, it would just kind of shake it up a bit as well, wouldn't it? And it's the way, let's face it, the way it should be. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that I'm really going to try and push hard to see representation. And I am the kind of in the strange world of the adopter reference group, which is part of the Department for Education. I'm in the room with the clocks again. Can you hear that?
Joy.
Deep joy. I've turned one of them off, but this one's that I missed one. So I'm the actual going to be sitting on the board for a year as the adopter representative, presuming that continues with the new head chair coming in. They might kind of go, oh, we're not having the likes of him here.
I don't want you lot in there. Yeah.
Oh, tush, tush, tush. Which is only reasonable because we've been sat at the table for a long time. I could get that. So that's a possibility. But that's where we're at, which I think is really... it just feels like a really interesting time, and I'm really hoping that we can get someone who can really drive through this representation that actually, because it's not just adopted people, it's birth families, as you say, it's also kinship carers, and I think they remain the kind of we go through all of the people who are impacted, and then we go, oh, and kinship carers, and if anything, they have a uniquely difficult experience of the whole adoption, fostering, permanency world. So I'm hugely intrigued by that. Now, I'm conscious that we've got our guest coming in soon. So I'll be honest with you. We do. We're kind of doing this in real time, which is terribly exciting. Oh, it's like being on the telly, isn't it? Yeah. I have to say, this is probably one of the, of all of the podcasts we've ever done, this is the one I've done the most preparation for. Which may not be apparent when the conversation starts.
But why did you feel that you had to do the preparation? As in, to go into the depths that you did?
Oh, well, that is the right question.
I
kind of have watched them over the years and just kind of I'm not particularly engaged in it. But I think that there's at the heart of what they do, there's this slight controversy in that no one can disagree with supporting parents who've lost their children, mums who've lost their children to adoption, especially those mums who kind of are in that a cycle of pregnant removal, adoption, pregnant removal, adoption. Absolutely. You know, there's no question about that. but there's this kind of murky thing about how they're funded, which sound, makes it sound really shadowy, doesn't it?
That does, yeah.
I've slipped into Donald Trumpisms there, if you forgive my language. There's this question mark about, because there is a condition that they have to go on contraception while they're on the program. So the program then sort of says, this is really successful because it works. But of course it works because everyone's on contraception. You can't get on the program unless you're in contraception. So you kind of excuse the figure slightly. So I just thought I'd better go away and do some real reading about that. And there's a DFE evaluation, which can be read. There's quite a few articles different people have written.
I think that's a really interesting kind of angle that you come to it at, but I personally don't see it like that. Like, I don't see how it skews figures, you know, because I think actually if you want to be part of that kind of service, then, you know, I'm not saying that, I'm not talking about like rights of a mother and all that sort of stuff. What I'm saying is, if you want to take part in something like that, you know, in the same way that if you want to adopt, a lot of agencies say, are you taking precautionary measures not to become pregnant?
Isn't that a mad comparison?
In what respect?
Let's not fall out before we've got a guest.
No, but I'm interested to know in what respect you mean, because, you know, some people say that's a scandalous thing to ask somebody just because you've gone down the adoption process. That doesn't mean to say that we should be doing that. But actually, I know quite a few people who didn't and got themselves into all sorts of trouble, you know.
Well, that is so common, isn't it?
The reasons that you'd be on the contraception are different. Don't get me wrong, but the end result would be the same. So, you know, I'm just saying that I don't see what, you know, I'm not seeing why it should be an issue on either.
It feels coercive that actually we're going to support you on the condition that you do this. Surely the support should be there regardless.
That's true. Yes, you're correct.
Thank you, I'll take that.
But then maybe there's a kind of an educational part to it as well.
Well, know? I don't know the details, and I did see that.
Exactly. We will find out.
There's a transition. I feel like it's like we've talked about someone like before a dinner party, and then we
do that often, do we not?
Yeah, we have a frank conversation about someone, then they come and it's all a bit awkward and frosty.
Yeah, or we forget that we've done it.
Yeah, not to worry. So here we are, as if by magic.
Yeah, I was just going to say, as if by magic.
Hello, Claire Laxton from Pause. How are you?
Hi there, I'm good, thanks. How are you guys?
Well, you know.
We've just been discussing me not getting a job, which most of the country is quite relieved about. So anyway, that's fine, don't worry. Thank you so much for coming on. We have been talking about you before you came on, so we do. There's a bit of tension, but okay, most of it was good, and we've spoke before. So Claire, could you tell me who you are, what your job title is, and, you know, just introduce yourself.
I will. So my name's Claire. So I'm the Director of Communications and Influencing at Pause, which is a charity that works with women who've had more than one child removed from their care. And my job is really about sort of talking about Pause, talking about women's experiences, and helping the sort of wider public understand and raise awareness of what women are experiencing, and also trying to change some things as well. So trying to sort of influence system change too.
Yeah, Scott, could you make a note that after the podcast, we need a meeting about changing my title to influencer, because I want to be an influencer.
I've made a note of that as your PA. Yeah.
Thank you. I've spent years trying to influence my children to tidy up after themselves and have failed this week.
I don't think it works like that.
There you go.
Sorry, this is a really flippant one. It's a really serious subject. I'm really sorry. I was just saying about, we put out a tweet a couple of days ago on Facebook and different places and said, hey, we're going to talk to Pause, and this is a little bit what you do, and some people think you're controversial. However, has anyone got any thoughts or questions? And it was very silent for a few days, and then we've had this tsunami of views and perspectives, haven't we, Scott?
Yes.
You've got some of them written down there. So if it's okay with you, can we sort of start with what people have sort of said and just some really basic questions. So we've got a few people who are kind of well known on the show, and but people who the our listeners would know too. So one of the first things people are asking really is, you know, what is the, well, I guess this is probably my question is, where did Pause come from and how long have you been going and what is your kind of your aims?
Yeah. So we started in 2013 and it came from two women, Sophie and Georgina, who wanted to support women that they were working with and saw that were sort of repeatedly having children removed from their care and obviously not getting support after that to stop it happening again, and are obviously experiencing the sort of all the trauma that is associated with that as well. So it started in Hackney in 2013. That was our first Pause practice. So the sort of Pause program is delivered through practices that are in local areas, and that's where Pause practitioners are and where they sort of work with women. So I've been going for about 7 years. We've reached around 1,500 women that have had about 4,500 children removed from their care. So we're talking, you know, big numbers, but actually not even scraping the top of the iceberg in terms of the women that need support.
All right, cool. I mean, when you say you mentioned the two people, were they social work practitioners?
So Sophie was leading the child protection service at Homerton Hospital in Hackney. So she was working with some of the women there that she was sort of seeing repeatedly.
All right, cool. Mm. That was a very thoughtful, Scott.
Well, it was, yeah, because I'm just thinking, like, to, you know, that at that stage. So at that stage, being working in a hospital, I'm talking about, that's kind of before I would even not think about where a child may come from. But in terms of a birth parent's journey, I mean, it starts before that, but actually that's probably the first place that things can be picked up is when they're at the medical appointments and stuff like that. So that must be kind of something that was missing in terms of what Sophie and Georgina saw. And to a point, still probably is in a lot of places. You know, I mean, let's face it, Pause doesn't cover the whole of the UK, does it? And there will be some places that maybe don't have access to that kind of service unless it's kind of purchased on a... And when I say purchased, I mean because these services are obviously funded by local authorities and stuff. Well, sorry, they're paid for by local authorities and stuff now. Mm-hmm. So what, how, I mean, how did they, was it something that just, sorry, I'm struggling to get the question out here, but was it just something that they went, right, let's try and do this a little bit differently. And that's something you might not know the answer to because obviously it's a while ago now, but should we try this differently? Or was it something they said, right, we need to set up an organization that, you know, that helps to do this?
I think it was, you know, at the beginning, sort of talking to other people who maybe were working with those women as well and thinking, actually, obviously, something does need to be done differently because for these women and their children, like, this just isn't working.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, Sophie sort of started to collect data and track some of these women and brought that to the attention of the local authority to... Right. Sort of move on to doing a more sort of in-depth study on the need and things like that and creating a business case for Pause and it sort of rolled from there. But I think, I mean, one of the biggest issues, which still remains, is that no one actually collects data on women that have children removed from their care more than once. So obviously there is... you know, children's records and all of that stuff. Yeah. And when we sort of what we call scope in a local area, you know, we have a person sort of manually looking through records, matching the women up and actually sort of finding what that number is. And that's, you know, not a perfect system, but because no one is actually collecting this data. So I think it was a sort of first time systematically someone wanted to pull that information together and do something about it.
Yeah, and I find that really interesting because I've sat in quite a few meetings where there's been representatives from Pause come along and it's been generally the kind of regional adoption special guardianship leadership board, and the one specifically that I remember, the Pause were really like bang on with their numbers and all their data, and I think that is kind of proof of the fact that there isn't any there. And in actual fact, you're trying to cover all bases with the data that you can provide in terms of being able to say, look, this works.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we, all the practices sort of collect data on women in terms of the outcomes and impacts of the practice. Mm. We sort of collect that centrally in terms of numbers. And that's really, you know, one of our, what we want to do is understand more about the numbers across the country sort of systematically, because it is that thing, isn't it? Until you sort of know numbers and data around the problem, it's really difficult to hold people to account and then sort of call for change and that maybe something needs to be done differently here.
Mm-hmm. I'm really intrigued by this because I've been thinking a lot about this because I know that there is controversy. You know, we had a pre-meeting to talk about what we were going to talk about, and I think you were just making sure I wasn't like Jeremy Praxman in disguise or something. And I genuinely thought you were going to come with like lawyers and things, but it was just us having a chat, so it was quite nice. But I've really thought a lot about this because I've always, if I'm honest, I feel a discomfort and I have to really check myself. What is that about? What, you know, is that just me being a soft, liberal, corduroy-wearing social worker? Or is there something else going on? Just in you describing that kind of the genesis of the organization, what do you think that the problem was looked at from a perspective of supporting mums or preventing children being born? Are they two separate things, or are they the same thing? That's what I'm sort of kind of get to the bottom of in my head.
I think the genesis was both those things. And I think that's where, you know, part of the PAUSE program is taking a pause in pregnancy. That's an important element of the program for the impact that it has. And I think as part of that, you know, we ask women to be on contraception, and for most women that's okay. For some women it's not, and actually we really take that on a case-by-case basis at the moment, and there are some women in our program that aren't on long-acting reversible contraception, and we sort of work with them on that. And I think, but it's that, for us, it's that principle of when we work with women that don't have children in their care, because if they did have children in their care, then obviously the practitioner would have to be thinking about safeguarding the children and sort of working on that element. And actually for a lot of women, working with PAUSE is the first time that they've been able to focus on themselves and sort of work on themselves and think about and have a professional sort of wanting to help them. So that it's an important element of the program, and I think, you know, that's why we have that. And as an organization, we're always learning. We're not perfect. We're currently doing a bit of reflection with our practices and women about the impact of asking them to use contraception and understanding more about the impact on them and practitioners and the outcomes. So, you know, we're always learning and thinking, basically.
Because that in some ways is a seed of one of the main criticisms, isn't it? That to access support, you were transitioned in to a point where a mum would say, oh, right, I'll be on contraception. And then you get access to someone coming and helping. And there's a lot, I guess there's a lot of social practitioners going, shouldn't we just be helping? Regardless of where people are at. And then because we talked about stats, and you obviously, it's your thing. It's Scott's thing as well. Scott's love his numbers. He'll be confounded with his little abacus having fun. But that then skews the results, isn't it? Because you can then say, well, everyone who's joined the support program then remained unpregnant. Well, of course they did, because the only people who could get on with that. So is that how it is now? Or are you sort of saying that you've evolved from that?
I think, you know, we've been going for 7 years. We've learned a lot from all of the women we've worked with and all of the sort of practices that have worked with them. You know, I think, as I said, we do have some women that aren't on long-acting reversible contraception. Some women do get pregnant during the program, and that is all worked through on a case-by-case basis with their practitioner. The actual intervention that makes the difference is the relationship between a woman and her practitioner, mm-hmm. that sort of intensive one-to-one focused relationship and the trust that they sort of build together.
Yeah.
The, you know, sort of contraception and taking a pause in pregnancy is an important aspect of it, but it's a sort of enabler of that relationship, if that makes sense.
That, yeah, I mean, yeah. the service isn't the same, but, you know, there are some kind of adoption, some of the voluntary adoption agencies specifically that actually have found, and I'm thinking about Adoption Plus as a specific example, that, you know, they did a lot of work with birth families. And it was a very similar kind of message that actually it's a relationship that they have with their therapist or counselor or, you know, whoever it is that they're kind of working with therapeutically that actually makes a difference, rather than kind of the, you know, and they can come in to the service and be angry and yeah, but it's about that relationship building that they've got. And that sounds very similar in some respects to what you guys are achieving as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's the thing that, you know, that is the thing that makes a yeah. difference and supports the woman to sort of achieve some of the positive things that she does.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you recall, and maybe it's my age, but a few years ago, I remember there was an American woman who came over from America, see how that works, and she was on GMTV or some such, and she was kind of like advocating very strongly for, she was going to pay for women to be sterilized, which is kind of like quite an extreme thing. Mm-hmm. But she was an adoptive parent, and she was kind of like one of these Uber adopters who was adopted 37 children. And she was saying, it's all well and good with your high morals and your high principles, but actually, you're not looking after the babies. Mm. And I just sort of that, I kind of really struggle with this idea that there's a lot of people saying, oh yeah, but it's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong. But in the midst of all that, you're saying there's 4,500 children that were not potentially not born, you know, that you've made a difference to those children, or that, you know, or a continuation of that number. Sorry, yeah. That's a better way of putting it. Because the reality is that the state isn't particularly great at looking after babies born into the system. Can we agree on that? Yay, we can agree on that. And even adoption is not without its flaws.
Of course.
Yeah. So, yeah. You're disarmingly nice, so I'm struggling to go really taxman on you. So it's.
What were you hoping for? For goodness sake, man.
I wanted a Martin Barrow moment, which you'll not know about, Claire, sorry, no. But I wanted a real, you want the truth, you can't handle a truth proper courtroom stuff. But that's not what we're having, is it?
All of these, with all these sorts of issues and questions, it's much more complex and nuanced than is easy to sort of put in a headline, really, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to work in sexual health. I am pro-choice. You know, really support, you know, massive support of sex and relationships education. Like, that is my background. And I think, you know, a lot of the women we work with have had absolutely no education around sexual reproductive health or healthy relationships or consent or all of that. So
yeah,
although we may be talking about contraception, it is a much, it's a much bigger thing, and I think it is much more nuanced and complex than sort of.
I guess. Yeah, and like a lot of things, you know, like you said, you're listening and learning and moving on and developing. And, you know, there's kind of, you know, the same way adoption used to be seen as a kind of, not a necessarily a golden bullet, but it was kind of deemed that way, and now we understand so much more about the trauma that it causes, not just in terms of, you know, how children are removed or abused or neglected, or but there's also a trauma about being adopted, there's a trauma about this, that, and the next thing. So, you know, it's a kind of, as we learn, agencies, you know, and local authorities, and they all develop as well, because actually, you know, there's new things being put into this all the time. And I guess it's exactly the same for you guys. And with being a relatively young service as well, you know, it kind of 2013, is that what you said? Yeah. That's hardly, you know, it's hardly anything at all, is it? So, you know, if it's making a difference this early on, after 7 years, then, you know, you kind of adjust and tweak to kind of
Definitely. And there's things, you know, there's lots of things that we've will have adjusted and changed and learned and, you know, tried to do better. And I think there will be lots of things in the future as well. We are not perfect, and, you know, we're not the only service either. There's lots of other services that offer support to birth parents after removal of children. And I think it's important to know that those exist across the country. It's not just practices.
Yeah, there's not just one.
Yeah.
I'm a trustee of one, just to give a shout out to Families in Care Newcastle. Freaking awesome. Did my first social work placement with there when I was but a child, a baby social worker back in 2010 or something. Can I ask you about, because there's sort of this, a lot of people who've answered or asked questions, have been asking from an adoption perspective. So is there sort of a post-adoption support role within PAWS? Is that just a natural kind of function of what you do?
So I think all of the all of our sort of PAWS practitioners will help women with whatever they need help with, and most of the time that includes things like contact arrangements. So depending on what arrangements their children have, they will support them with that. So where, you know, women who we work with have had their children adopted, the sort of PAWS practitioner will help them a lot, either like work through sort of managing that loss, accepting that responsibility, like so some of that sort of emotional work that needs to happen with the woman, but also some of the practical stuff like contact arrangements. So depending on what they are, I think with adoption, most of the women have letterbox contact, which I think, you know, is a pretty flawed system.
That was a very delicately put.
But, you know, PAWS practitioners will help them write letters if they have trouble reading and writing and things like that, and sort of advocate for them if they haven't received a letter and those sorts of things. So I think with when their child or children have been adopted, there are the sort of practical stuff that PAWS practitioners will help them with, and there's the sort of emotional working through issues that they will help them with as well. So a lot of that work happens,
because a lot of the questions we had were from people sort of that were in relation to contact. And often adopters, I think adopters start from a position of probably quite fear and nervous and anxiety. But as time goes on, then often adopters feel much more chilled out about it and try and, you know, adopters are not perfect, but they're often they relax into it and then are looking to embrace contact and looking to kind of make it more meaningful. Yeah. And so there was a lot of questions in relation to that about how, you know, the support that you give to the women that you work with.
I think with contact arrangements as well, like there are, so many of the women we work with have different contact arrangements for different children. So I guess on, you know, in one instance, they're probably managing quite a lot of, for want of a better word, admin around their contact arrangements and all the emotions that go with all of the different types of arrangements that they have. So some of them find it really difficult to engage with contact. And I think on the flip side, from, you know, the caring family or the adoptive parents' point of view, that's probably really difficult to manage. And I think what our practitioners try and do is a lot of that, like, preparation work, if it's direct contact, you know, supporting them with, like, getting to the place on time, like, knowing where it is. And then after it's happened, like a sort of debrief type thing, you know, so to sort of manage the whole process of a instance of contact. And I think that's really important to help women get over some of those practical challenges of just engaging.
And do you feel that PAWS and the practitioners have been able to influence some change in terms of contact arrangements as well? And what I mean by that, I'm not talking about specific cases. I'm talking about, you know, generically. I mean, you know, for us as long in the tooth adopters, we're very keen to kind of think about what contact looks like and whether it's right. And you know, we to some points not even want to use the word contact. Actually, it's about, you know, connection and you know, keeping that kind of relationship going in some way, because it's, you know, it's a huge loss. Do you? I mean, maybe not, but do you think that you know, Paws has kind of got a seat around that table in terms of being influenced that change?
I think so, in terms of definitely some of the local areas that Paws practices work in. Like, they've, you know, sort of built relationships with like the letterbox coordinator or something like that, and sort of tried to help help the process just be a bit better and more friendly. And I think you're right in the sense of, you know, contact arrangements just makes it sound like such a sort of administrative process, doesn't it? Whereas actually what it's trying to do is build relationships and sort of, you know, create family time, really. So I think some of what practices try and do is like just really humanize the process effectively. But yeah, there's been some good sort of local changes that practices have made, and I think just raising awareness of some of those barriers that women and birth mothers might have to engaging in contact has been really helpful locally. I think,
I mean, clearly it's not, you know, like every contact arrangement is different for every family, you know, so just to be clear on that. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that everybody should have the same kind of contact arrangements, but you know, it's obviously really good to hear that, you know, there's another organization who are trying to kind of make everybody think outside the box in terms of how it works, if it's appropriate for the child and the birth family, and, you know, let's face it, for the adoptive parents as well, because it needs to be right for everybody, really, if it's in the best interest of the child.
I've got a few really specific questions, so I don't want to put you on the spot, because I know that you don't practice, you know, you're not a practitioner. So if you feel like you don't want to answer them, that's
don't
cool.
Don't take me for a practitioner, like, none of these skills.
Right, okay. But one of the questions we got was in relation to what can adopters do to help the birth mums engage in contact. You know, I think that's one of the big questions we hear all the time is, well, what should I write to this mum who's lost a child? You know, we've had a lovely time. We've been to Saint-Tropez for the summer. You know, adopters' lives can be so removed from the circumstances of birth mums. So is there any sort of anything you could, you know, perhaps shed some light on in relation to that?
I think, you know, what I hear really clearly from when I talk to women, particularly around contact arrangements, it's something that they, you know, are really passionate about and sort of want to see changes made. I think it's really about sort of knowing who they are. So they, you know, they want their child to still know who they are and what their experiences have been, and that they're doing, that their child's doing okay, and that they're okay. And I think it is, you know, it is as basic as sort of just knowing that their child's okay, knowing that they're in a loving family, but also, you know, supporting their child to sort of know their story in a way. So I think it's being honest about that. And that's really difficult in lots of cases, and how you approach that and how you think about their experiences is really complex. And I'm not saying in any way it's a simple thing to do.
And that idea of just letting families know that they're not being forgotten, and that can be complicated for adopters, because they might go, again, there might be a whole raft. I mean, for every, we can't even give an example, because they're all so incredibly unique. So thinking, I do have lots of questions.
As you can see, because I can't get a word.
Shut up. Let's not bicker in front of our guests.
Why not?
Again, no.
Let's have a sip of tea, hang on.
Yeah, go on, sip your tea. I think, they've gone out of my head now, that's stupid. No, what happens then? When does this, when does this come to an end then? So is this infinite support? Is it finite? What is the moment when you go, actually, we've run out of money? Or is it a set period of you will get a year, yeah, get 2 years? Right. Well, so explain
that
to
me. Sort of pause program, if you like, is an 18-month program of that intensive one-to-one support with a practitioner and a woman. So the first sort of few weeks of that, up to sort of 16 weeks, is really working with the women to see if she wants to be on pause, like if she's ready for the program, and sort of maybe sorting out some of those really urgent practical issues like housing and sort of, you know, financial support and things like that. So they have 18 months of the pause program, and then we have what's called our next steps offer, which is effectively for women that have gone through the pause program but still want to sort of have support from us. So we're trialing lots of different ways of offering next step support, but some areas have a next steps practitioner that can sort of offer a bit more light touch support, if you like, and groups and things like that. And we've got women will soon be able to become peer supporters, so they will be able to help women that are on the program and things like that. So, you know, it's not perfect. As with many things, as we sort of talked about earlier, it's really dependent on funding. It's not a statutory service, so, you know, local authorities fund it. We fundraise for it as well, and we get other funding for our services too.
Are you centrally funded?
We have from the DfE. Yeah, we've had grants from the DfE Innovation Fund as well that go into practices, and then local authorities will put money in too. So that's always an issue. We've lost some pause practices because of funding and sustainability. And that's really difficult because, you know, we very strongly question how that local area is going to support those women that have been on the program.
I guess one of the issues is that there's a statutory requirement for local authorities to provide support to mums who've lost their children to adoption. And also, under the Adoption Act, that you get that in some ways you need an assessment. But the reality is that why would you want to be supported by the very people, organization or even individual that had been part of that decision-making process to remove your child? You've got to be someone remarkably resilient to kind of take that support from that person. That's a tricky one.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's where sort of support from places like PAWS and the other services that give support to
reframe
to others. Exactly.
Clarissa, friend of the show.
Yeah.
It's really important. And, you know, we're able to have differences in the way we work. So, like, our pause practitioners don't have sort of more than 8 women on their caseload. And that's a really important part of the model because it helps them keep that sort of intensive relationship. And, you know, with the best will in the world and local authority, assuming that sort of caseload isn't going to be possible. So, you know, there's things that we can do differently and other programs can do differently that really make a difference in that way to women.
Can I ask you about peer support? Because you mentioned that. So that I've not particularly read anything about that. I can kind of hypothesize what that would be about, but what does that look like and why does that come from?
So it really came from women who had graduated from PAWS and sort of want to keep involved and they want to help other women, basically. So we're looking at creating an offer of training some women to be peer supporters, so sort of putting them through a sort of a professional qualification, and then the idea is potentially they could speak to women at the beginning of who come into the PAWS program, right at the beginning, and sort of tell them what it's like and, you know, what to expect and how they got through it. And that, I guess, it's effectively to show that there's other people that have been through it and they're not alone. And, you know, often that message is better received from a peer rather than a professional.
Scott, you got any questions? Because I'm just butting in all the time.
No, you're fine. I'm just happy to just sit here and take notes, you know, just summarize the whole conversation. Yeah,
you'll be writing up the minutes afterwards. I think probably, just for the lawyers, what is it like being part of an organization that is controversial? And I mean, if you Google pause, and you know, people will, you can find there's lots of criticism out there. What is it like being part of an organization where, you know, you seem perfectly reasonable? However, I am aware that you are a professional influencer. You might be influencing me even as we speak. It's a Jedi mind trick you're doing on me because I'm quite weak-minded. Say you're doing it again.
I have my Newcastle United stuff in the background as a sort of...
Yeah, apparently you're a Newcastle United fan. Well, you know, there you go. I'll see what inside information I can get for you, being from Newcastle and all. See, you did it. You influenced me. Do you see what she does? It's like a sinister... What is it like being part of an organization that's controversial? You know, why would you take that job, for one? And what is it? Is there a kind of a bunker mentality? Because you're considered to be kind of part of this neoliberal kind of compassionate conservatism kind of thing, which doesn't sit nicely with some social work practitioners.
Yeah. I guess in the first question, like from a personal point of view, as I said before, I used to work in sexual health, campaigning on pro-choice issues. Quite a lot of people didn't like me for that. I've worked in domestic abuse and quite a lot of people didn't like me for that. So I think really it's about the difference that that organization and the people in it are making to people's lives. And I think with pause, the women we work with are often, you know, some of the most forgotten, most stigmatized, you know, most traumatized people in society. And I think the difference that, you know, pause makes and the difference that relationship and sort of support makes to their lives is really inspiring. And, you know, we work with women, I talk to them, they've been on our podcast, they sort of, you know, work with us on lots of the stuff we do, and I love it. You know, I guess.
Fair enough.
So you must need thick skin, a little bit like some of the kind of the women that you work with as well. You know, it's I'm not kind of putting you on the same level in terms of the kind of thick skin you should have, but you know, to take that criticism as an organisation and as an individual who's worked in all those kind of things, you must need that kind of thick skin and just not really, you know, if it's something that you're passionate about and believe in, then you know. You need
absolutely. You've got to take that thick skin, especially when you work in communications, because you know that's where you get the criticism.
Yeah, you should see our complaints team.
broken people.
But I think, you know, without sounding too sort of, you know, trite, like if you believe in it and you care about it and you can see you see the difference, it's much easier to sort of take that criticism. You know, I think we're very open to talking to anyone that sort of wants to talk to us and, you know, learn from some of that feedback. I don't think we're a sort of, you know, closed organization.
Yeah.
We're still learning.
I'm really struggling. I don't know why, and I'm trying to get to the bottom of it. I'm employing all my social worker skills to kind of work out why there's just something I can't get to the bottom of it in my
why you're not still feeling Paxman like.
No, I just this tension remains between sort of this conditionality about it that. And that just really sits uncomfortably. But then my pragmatist head says, yes, but the outcomes. And I can't resolve that those two positions really struggle for me. And, you know, I'm a bleeding heart liberal, and I know I am. I don't look like it. I look like a bloody lumberjack today with my check shirt and my beard. But I do hold those two positions really. But there's a lot of this area that we work, I mean, in social work, in our lives as adoptive parents, that we hold these pragmatic positions, but it's the outcome, isn't it? Is it?
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, cost? That's why, you know, on sort of contraception as a sort of specific issue, we are always learning, we are reflecting, we're sort of... how it impacts on women practices, and that's really important. And I guess, you know, if you want to come and chat to some of the women that we work with, you'd be very welcome, and they will be able to tell you much better than me about how they feel on the program.
Like,
and
I feel like that is something that we would do, and I'm kind of looking at train times now, so we'll sort that after afterwards. But I do feel like there's this there's a massive disconnect between the kind of the carers and parents of children who have been removed from birth parents and birth parents. And I don't know if that's kind of, you know, and I'm talking from a different perspective as Al, because I'm not a social worker. I'm too stupid to be a social worker. But there's kind of a big divide, a big gap in terms of where birth parents are and where adoptive parents or kinship care, or, you know, I mean, there's kind of even more complexities in terms of kinship care and special guardians, especially if they're families and, you know, stuff like that. But I guess in my head now, 15, 16 years on, there shouldn't be a gap. I should have a relationship with my three children's birth mother and birth father if that's what they want and that's what my children want. It shouldn't necessarily be about me. So I guess for me, you know, that kind of opportunity to begin looking at how we can make that happen as a part of the process of adoption. And yes, we could sit here and talk about, you know, supporting families before it gets to that stage. But let's face it, practically, that's not always going to be a success either. You know, there are going to be some situations where it does go down that route. So I guess for me, my kind of aspect, my kind of viewpoint of this is that, you know, it's like working collaboratively to find the... There's never a solution to this, but it's finding the best ways to work. And obviously, each birth parent's different, each child is different, each adoptive family is different. But if we can kind of do that earlier and make it part of the process, then there is going to be, children are going to become adults who haven't been through that kind of same loss as what we've got at the minute, if you know what I mean, and vice versa for birth parents. Mm. I feel like I was on my soapbox there. Sorry.
But I think, like, you know, it's the process that sort of dictates how it happens, isn't it? So at the moment, like...
we have a Victorian process.
Yeah, you know, the process is, right, at adoption, this is what your contact's going to be for the rest of your life. Sort of off you go. Kind of thing. And that just doesn't feel, particularly around letterbox contact, it doesn't feel... like, it feels like we've moved on in our understanding of sort of relationships between birth parents and children that have been adopted, and what's important, and the sort of, you know, positive impacts of really good contact and how we can make that work. So it does feel like our understanding's moved on from that loads, but the process hasn't. So that sort of dictates everything that happens. So, you know, I know that you... I've spoken to Beth Neal on the podcast, and some of what she was talking about, I think it was in New South Wales in Australia, where they've got a sort of lifelong sort of story birth parent adoptive child connection, and that's a sort of intention with their process. You know, it feels like something like that would make more sense for families and work better. And it is, you know, the process has to change, because that's where professional student, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that even the adoption, the Children Adoption Act 2002, or whatever it is, adoption support, so that's the legislation that kind of the adoption's built on.
Whatever.
That was 2002. And just look at the way... look at what's happened in those years. You know, you could stretch back 20 years before that, and there's no big change. But we've got the advent of social media, and it's changed everything about how we connect. Mm-hmm. And you know, in 2002, to find someone, you had to literally leave your house and go and find them. Now you can go to your bedroom and be cross with your adoptive parents and find your mum and dad, and you know, we've rehearsed that conversation 1,000 times, but it seems like it becomes more prescient every year. We need to get on board with that. There you are. That was just no question.
Do you guys think there's like a particular reason why that hasn't changed? Like, has there not been a sort of strong enough? You know, why has it not changed?
You know, I think we probably come at this from different perspectives as well, because obviously I was a social worker. So off you go, Al.
I think it's not changed because adopters don't want it to change.
Okay.
Sorry, go on. I didn't realise you weren't finished. No, go on.
And I think there's got to be a political will. There's got to be votes in it. There's got to be a movement of professionals and parents and a whole community that says, this needs to happen, please do it. And until that happens, we'll not see any changes, because the scope within the current regulations to do a lot of stuff, but actually we need people to be testing that and pushing that to the limit and going, we need better, we need more scope or whatever. So that's my perspective, for what it's worth. Yeah.
And my perspective is that it's kind of linked, actually, which I'm surprised about, to what Al's saying. But I think that in some ways there's a fear within social work as well about how potentially it can go. And that does influence adoptive parents especially, who may feel that they have to do what the social worker says, especially early days.
Yeah.
Because they're still under that kind of assessment and being judged. And, you know, that's how they feel. So I think that, you know, certainly for me, I would never have challenged it 15, 16 years ago. But as time goes on, you understand your children, you know, you understand their background, their experiences, their history, you know, and let's face it, they're living with strangers and you're living with a stranger to begin with. But as time moves on, you get to know their needs and, you know, but we don't know the needs of the birth family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the kind of conflict. So I think some of it is in the middle there, the adopters who are the kind of the buffer between the two kind of.
I think I have to apologize to the people who sent the questions. We've not asked any, there's not been very many specific questions. There was more thoughts and comments, so some of them didn't really fit into the conversation.
I have looked, and we have kind of covered most of them in the roundabout way. Yes, we have.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that I would ask, actually, and you may not be able to answer this, Claire, is and it's from the perspective of a birth mother. What is kind of one of is there specific questions that they're asked that they're just like, oh, for crying out loud, please don't be stupid, don't ask me that. And the reason I ask that is because I think that we would all like to understand birth parents a little bit more, if that makes sense.
I don't think I can answer that question, to be honest, because I don't think I know.
We finally got her.
Right at the end.
It's a hard one to ask as well, to answer as well, to be fair, because there's you know, everybody, like we said, we've threaded throughout this, you know, everybody's experience is different, isn't it?
Very different, and so sort of unique. And I guess, you know,
I think that's one to ask the birth parent, a birth mother, isn't it, you know, specifically.
Definitely. And you know, I think I don't, you know, I wouldn't want to sit here and tell you that I know what they're thinking or
that's fair.
That'd be wonderful. If we asked you nicely, would you maybe be willing to we would love to kind of have a podcast where we could talk to birth mums. If there was ever anyone that you thought would enjoy that or find that helpful or would be willing to kind of share their experience and insights. So, because I think that there's nothing, you know, stories and people's perspectives from the horse, literally from the horse's mouth, would be wonderful. So you can go and do your influencing magic on them.
Well, we had we've done a project on contact arrangements, and we had two women on the sort of advisory group for that, and they were on our podcast episode about contact arrangements. So I will ask them.
Yeah, that'd be really good.
That'd be wonderful.
Because it's a different kind of perspective. Your podcast, I have listened to a very small amount of it, because I don't really listen to podcasts, because I don't even listen to this one, to be honest. So, but I think it's the aim of yours is obviously from a different perspective to ours as well. So it'd be interesting to see how that kind of matched up with the, you know, because yes, and don't get me wrong, everybody should go and listen to the podcast, obviously. But equally, you know, to come kind of this side of the coin as well, because we want to, you know, there's kind of, if they're able to answer some of the questions that we've got, and they will be probably quite, you know, what's the word I'm looking for, not intrusive, that came to my head there, but it'd be kind of practical questions, and you know, like, what can adopters do to help you as well as help our children, kind of thing, you know, it's from that perspective, I guess.
There'd be real value in that, wouldn't there?
Yeah, and asking women sort of how, what their experience was and how they felt is, you know, it's much better to hear it from them than
me.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I apologise for my clock, but that's telling us that we've run out of time. That's
beautiful, isn't it? Cinderella, you will not go.
I must run now. See, I feel thoroughly disarmed by this conversation. I feel
I'm
a
glad.
Bit better.
You know, this happens very rarely, Claire. Very rarely does this happen.
Are you feeling sufficiently influenced?
Yeah, because he thinks he thinks he's going to get over him, I guess. And I'm like, nah, you're not going to do that. No, I'm joking. He didn't say that. But it's great to see Al disarmed now and again, because just because it's funny, for a start, that's the first thing. But secondly, because actually it's like changing people's minds about things that are going on in the world, you know.
Yes,
and I think, I mean, yeah, it's been great to chat to you. Thanks for having me on. And I think if there are some women that are keen to chat to you, we will ask them, because again, I think it's always good to hear it from their direct experience.
Yeah,
that would be wonderful. So that's it, really. We're not going to do an outro. Normally we do an outro, but we've decided we weren't going to, because that would be talking behind your back. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for giving us your evening, which I know is probably very valuable. And so thank you very much.
Thank you so much. No, it's been brilliant. I hope it didn't disarm you too much, but no, it's been really great to chat to you and just answer all your questions.
You're welcome.
Excellent.
No problem. Thank
you. Okie dokie. Bye.
Thanks very much. See you later.
Bon Jovi.